A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Stores, Connecticut, in late August. The air is thick and warm, the kind of humidity that makes your shirt cling to your back after 10 minutes outside. You're walking a trail through the woods near Mansfield Hollow, and the undergrowth is lush and damp. You can't see them, but they're there, waiting in the leaf litter, on the tips of grass blades, front legs extended, ready to latch onto anything warm that brushes past. Daniel's spending a couple of weeks there, and he sent us a prompt with 4 questions folded into it. He wants to know what Lyme disease actually is, why it's a genuine concern in a place like Storrs, how it became this fixture of online self-diagnosis culture, and what the science actually says about so-called chronic Lyme, and, most practically, what the safety protocol is for someone hiking or letting kids play outdoors in a Lyme-prone area without spiraling into paranoia. So let's start with what Lyme disease actually is, and why a town like Storrs is ground zero for it.
Lyme disease is a bacterial infection caused by Borrelia burgdorferi. It's a spirochete, a spiral-shaped bacterium, which matters because that corkscrew shape lets it burrow into tissues in ways a round bacterium can't. It's transmitted through the bite of an infected black-legged tick, Ixodes scapularis, which is the deer tick. And the classic early sign is erythema migrans, the bullseye rash. Expanding red ring with central clearing shows up in roughly 70 to 80% of confirmed cases, which means 1 in 5 people never get the rash at all. Storrs is in Tolan County, and Tolan County has one of the highest Lyme incidence rates in the United States. This isn't subtle. Connecticut as a whole is the historical epicenter. Lyme disease was first identified in Old Lyme, Connecticut in 1975 after a cluster of pediatric arthritis cases that nobody could explain. Mothers in the area noticed their kids were developing swollen knees and wrists, and the local medical community was stumped. Eventually, they traced it to tick bites.
1975. That's remarkably recent for a disease that now infects nearly 500,000 Americans a year.
The CDC's current numbers, and these are for May and June of this year, put it at about 476,000 Americans diagnosed and treated for Lyme annually. The vast majority are concentrated in the Northeast and Upper Midwest. Connecticut's incidence rate per 100,000 is consistently in the top 5 states nationally. This isn't a rare disease in that part of the world, it's endemic.
And the tick that carries it. I've heard people call them deer ticks, but the Latin name you use suggests something more specific.
Ixodes scapularis. The black-legged tick. It has a 2-year life cycle with 3 stages, larva, nymph, adult. The nymph stage is the one that causes most human infections, and nymphs are most active from May through July. They're tiny, about the size of a poppy seed. You can miss them easily. The adults are larger and more visible, but they feed mostly in the cooler months, fall and early spring. The nymphs are the real transmission vector, and late summer in Connecticut, right now, is still within the window where you need to be paying attention.
A poppy seed. So the thing that gives you a potentially debilitating illness is roughly the size of a punctuation mark.
And it's not aggressive in the way people imagine. Ticks don't jump, they don't fly, they don't drop from trees. That's a myth I want to kill right now. They wait in low vegetation, grass, brush, leaf litter. They climb to the tip of a blade of grass and extend their front legs. It's called questing. And they wait for something to brush past. A deer, a dog, a human ankle. When you walk through tall grass at the edge of a field, you're walking through a field of tiny extended arms.
I'm going to think about that phrase for the rest of the episode. But the epidemiological reality is only half the story here. Lyme disease has taken on a second life online, and that's where things get complicated.
The mechanism of infection is worth understanding first, because it's the foundation for everything else. The tick has to be attached for 36 to 48 hours to transmit Borrelia. It's not instantaneous. The bacteria live in the tick's midgut, and they need time to migrate to the salivary glands after the tick starts feeding. That window is everything. It's why tick checks work. If you find and remove a tick within 24 hours of attachment, your transmission risk drops to near zero.
So the system is forgiving. That's the first thing Daniel needs to hear.
Very forgiving. And if you do get infected, early stage Lyme is treatable. A 2 to 4 week course of doxycycline, amoxicillin, or ceftriaxone clears the infection in the vast majority of cases. The problem, and this is where the diagnostic challenge comes in, is that confirming you have it isn't as straightforward as people assume.
How so?
The standard testing protocol is a two-tier system. First, an ELISA test, enzyme-linked immunosorbent assay, which looks for antibodies against Borrelia. If that's positive or equivocal, you follow up with a Western blot, which is more specific. But here's the catch. Both tests detect antibodies, not the bacteria itself. Your body takes time to produce antibodies. In the first few weeks after infection, the test can be negative even if you have Lyme. That's the window period. On the flip side, antibodies can persist for months or years after successful treatment. So a positive test doesn't necessarily mean active infection.
So you have a test that can miss early cases and can't distinguish between a cured infection and an ongoing one.
And that ambiguity, the gap between what the test shows and what the patient is experiencing, is the crack that the online self-diagnosis community has poured through.
Daniel's third question. How did Lyme become an internet phenomenon?
The term you hear is chronic Lyme disease. And I want to be precise here because this gets heated fast. Chronic Lyme disease, as a diagnosis, isn't recognized by the CDC or the Infectious Diseases Society of America, the IDSA. It's not in the International Classification of Diseases. What's recognized is something called post-treatment, Lyme disease syndrome, or PTLDS, persistent symptoms like fatigue, joint pain, and cognitive fuzziness that last for months after the infection has been cleared. The key distinction, PTLDS, acknowledges the symptoms are real but doesn't attribute them to ongoing active infection.
And the chronic Lyme community attributes them to persistent Borrelia that's hiding somewhere in the body.
That's the claim, that the bacteria can evade antibiotics, burrow into tissues, and cause a vast constellation of symptoms. Fatigue, brain fog, joint pain, depression, anxiety, insomnia, neuropathy, you name it. And because the symptoms are so nonspecific, the diagnosis becomes a kind of catch-all. If you're tired and achy and your doctor can't find anything wrong, online communities will tell you it might be chronic Lyme.
And is there evidence for persistent infection?
Multiple NIH-funded treatment trials have looked at this directly. The landmark study is the Klempner trial, published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2016. They took patients with persistent symptoms after treated Lyme and gave them 90 days of intravenous ceftriaxone, a powerful antibiotic, versus placebo, 90 days of IV antibiotics. The result? No difference in outcomes between the treatment group and the placebo group. No improvement in fatigue, no improvement in pain, no improvement in cognitive function.
90 days of IV antibiotics, and it did nothing.
Nothing beyond what the placebo did. There were follow-up studies too. The PLEASE study, the SLICE trials, all of them found the same thing. Prolonged antibiotic therapy doesn't help patients with so-called chronic Lyme. And prolonged antibiotics aren't harmless. They carry risks. C. difficile colitis, antibiotic resistance, Lyme infections from the IV catheter. People have died from complications of long-term IV antibiotic treatment for chronic Lyme.
So the evidence is clear. And yet?
And yet there's a parallel medical reality. There's an organization called ILADS, the International Lyme and Associated Diseases Society, that argues for long-term antibiotic treatment based on clinical experience and patient testimonials. Their guidelines recommend 4 to 6 weeks of antibiotics for early disease and up to 12 months for chronic Lyme. The IDSA guidelines, which are the standard of care, recommend 10 to 14 days for early uncomplicated cases. That's not a small disagreement. That's two completely different approaches to the same condition.
12 months of antibiotics versus 2 weeks.
And patients are caught in the middle. You have someone who's been sick for years, who's seen a dozen doctors, who's been told their symptoms are psychosomatic, or it's all in their head, and then they find a community online that says, "We believe you, we have a name for what you have, and here's a doctor who will treat it." That's incredibly powerful. The chronic Lyme movement didn't emerge from nowhere. It filled a vacuum that the medical establishment created.
I want to sit with that for a moment, because it's where the whole controversy lives. The symptoms are real. The suffering is real. The attribution to persistent Borrelia infection is what the evidence doesn't support.
Right. And the thing is, there are plausible mechanisms for post-treatment symptoms that don't require ongoing infection. One hypothesis is that the infection triggers an autoimmune response that keeps going after the bacteria are gone, similar to what happens in reactive arthritis after a gastrointestinal infection. Another is that the initial infection causes tissue damage that takes a long time to heal. A third is that some patients had underlying conditions, chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia, depression, that were either triggered or unmasked by the Lyme infection. None of those require the bacteria to still be there.
But those explanations are less satisfying than a single clear enemy you can name and fight.
Much less satisfying. And the internet loves a clear enemy. The chronic Lyme community online is vast. Forums, Facebook groups, dedicated subreddits. People share treatment protocols, recommend Lyme-literate doctors, post lists of symptoms that run to 50 or 60 items. The diagnostic tests some of these practitioners use aren't FDA approved. They're private labs using criteria that return positive results at rates far higher than the standard two-tier test. A study from 2019 found that some of these alternative labs had positivity rates above 50% in healthy controls.
50% of healthy people testing positive.
For a test to mean anything, it needs to be negative in people who don't have the disease. If half of healthy controls test positive, the test is worthless. But if you're a patient who's been searching for an answer for years, and someone hands you a lab report that says positive for Lyme, you're not going to question the methodology.
Oh, no, you're going to feel vindicated.
And you're going to start antibiotics, maybe oral, maybe IV. You're going to join the online communities and share your story. The cycle reinforces itself.
So if the science is clear that chronic Lyme isn't a validated diagnosis, what does that mean for someone who actually lives in or visits a Lyme endemic area? Let's get practical.
This is where my local knowledge actually matters. I grew up in stores. I know those trails. The Mansfield Hollow Trails, the Fenton River Trail, the Yukon Forest, all of them are tick habitat. The deer population in Tolan County is high, and deer are the primary host for adult ticks. Where there are deer, there are ticks. But the risk isn't evenly distributed.
What do you mean?
Ticks live in leaf litter, tall grass, and brush. They need humidity to survive. They desiccate easily. A manicured lawn that's mowed short and gets full sun isn't good tick habitat. The edge of the woods, the overgrown field margin, the trail that hasn't been maintained. That's where the risk concentrates. If you're walking on a well-maintained trail, staying in the center, not brushing against vegetation, your risk is much lower than if you're bushwhacking through tall grass.
So the risk is manageable with some basic awareness.
Very manageable. And the single most effective thing you can do is the tick check. The CDC recommends checking within 24 hours of coming indoors. High-yield areas, behind the knees, groin, armpits, scalp, behind the ears, the waistband. Ticks like warm, moist, concealed areas. The gold standard is the naked tick check in front of a mirror, full-body visual inspection. It takes 2 minutes.
2 minutes?
2 minutes. And if you shower within 2 hours of coming indoors, you can wash off ticks that haven't attached yet. Combine the shower with the check, and you've covered most of the risk. The 36 to 48 hour attachment window means you have time. The system is forgiving if you use it.
What about repellents?
The CDC recommends DEET at 20 to 30% concentration on exposed skin. For clothing, permethrin. You treat the clothes, not the skin, and it lasts through several washes. Light-colored clothing makes ticks easier to spot. Tucking pants into socks is unfashionable but effective. It creates a barrier. These aren't exotic measures. They're cheap, they're widely available, and they work.
And if you find a tick that's attached?
Fine-tipped tweezers. Grasp as close to the skin as possible. Pull straight upward with steady, even pressure. Don't twist, that can break off the mouth parts and leave them in the skin. Don't apply petroleum jelly, nail polish, or a hot match. Those old folk remedies increase the risk of transmission because they can cause the tick to regurgitate into the wound. Clean the bite area with rubbing alcohol or soap and water afterward. Save the tick in a sealed bag if you want it identified or tested, though testing the tick isn't routinely recommended.
Those folk remedies, the hot match, the petroleum jelly, they're exactly the kind of thing that sounds plausible and is actually worse than doing nothing.
They stress the tick. A stressed tick regurgitates. Regurgitation means you get a bolus of bacteria injected directly into the bite. You've taken a low-risk situation and made it high-risk because you remembered something your grandmother told you.
Leaf medicine would never.
Corn, your leaf medicine involves chewing eucalyptus and hoping for the best. Please don't.
Fair. Now, the psychological dimension. Daniel specifically asked how to check for ticks without becoming paranoid about it. That's harder to answer.
It is, because the internet makes it hard. You search for Lyme disease, and within 3 clicks, you're reading about someone who's been bedridden for a decade. Those stories are real, and they're terrifying, but they're also extremely rare. The base rate is what matters. In a Lyme-endemic area, if you get a tick bite, the probability that bite leads to infection is about 1 to 3%. 1 to 3%. Even in the highest risk areas, the vast majority of tick bites don't result in Lyme disease.
A 1 to 3% conversion rate puts it in perspective.
And of that small percentage who get infected, the vast majority clear it with a short course of oral antibiotics. Neurologic Lyme, the scary stuff, meningitis, facial palsy, carditis, is uncommon. The horror stories aren't the typical case. The typical case is you get a rash, you take doxycycline for 2 weeks, you're fine.
The mental framework is something like, the risk is real, but the system works.
Make the tick check a ritual, not an anxiety spiral. Treat it like brushing your teeth, something you do routinely, without emotional charge. You come in from a hike, you shower, you check, it takes a few minutes. You do it, and then you're done. You don't spend the rest of the evening Googling symptoms.
For kids playing on the lawn, Daniel mentioned young children.
If the lawn is mowed and gets sun, the risk is low. Ticks don't thrive on short, dry grass. The risk zone is the edge, where the lawn meets the woods or the tall brush. If kids are playing in that transition zone, check them when they come in. Behind the ears and the hairline are especially important for children, and teach them that tick checks are normal, not scary, just something you do, like washing your hands.
You mentioned the deer population earlier. Storrs has a lot of deer.
Tolan County is lousy with deer, and deer are the reproductive host for adult ticks. That's where the female tick takes her final blood meal before laying eggs. More deer means more ticks. There's been research on deer reduction as a Lyme prevention strategy, and it does reduce tick populations, but it's not something an individual hiker can control. What you can control is your own behavior in tick habitat.
One thing I've heard, and I want you to confirm or kill this, is that ticks are more active at certain times of day.
They're most active when humidity is high. Early morning, late afternoon, after rain. Midday in full sun, when it's dry, they retreat into the leaf litter to avoid desiccation. So if you're hiking, mid-morning to early afternoon on a dry day is lower risk than dawn or dusk, but I wouldn't structure my whole life around that. The tick check is the equalizer.
I spent a summer dragging a white flannel cloth through the woods of Tolan County collecting ticks for the state.
Of course you did.
1998. The Connecticut Agricultural Experiment Station ran a tick surveillance program. I was a field tech. The job was to walk a transect through the woods with this white cloth. Looked like a flag on a pole. And every 20 meters, you'd stop and count how many ticks had latched onto it. Ixodes scapularis nymphs, mostly. Some adults. The data went into the state's Lyme disease monitoring maps. My supervisor was an entomologist named Dr. Eleanor something. She kept a jar of preserved ticks on her desk. I knocked it over once. Spent an hour picking up dead ticks from the carpet while she watched without saying a word.
Did you get the scar from that?
No, that was a live one. First day on the job, behind my left knee. I didn't check. By the time I noticed it, it had been on there maybe 2 days. The doxycycline they gave me turned my skin photosensitive for a month. I looked like a lobster every time I went outside.
You were collecting ticks for science, and a tick collected you first.
I wasn't good at the job. But I've been listening to you two talk about the chronic Lyme controversy, and I want to say something. Not about the science, which I think you've got right. About the framing. You said the internet amplifies rare horror stories. That's true. But what I saw in 98 was that the medical establishment was genuinely dismissive of Lyme patients for years. The IDSA guidelines back then said Lyme was hard to catch and easy to treat, and doctors in Connecticut were telling patients with real symptoms that it was psychosomatic. that it was in their heads. I watched it happen. People in my own town. That created a trust vacuum. When a doctor tells you your pain isn't real, and then you find a community of people who say they believe you and they have a name for what you have, you go there. You don't care about the clinical trial data. You care that someone is finally listening. The chronic Lyme movement filled that vacuum. It's not that the science is wrong now. It's that the institutions lost credibility first, and they've never really gotten it back.
That's a fair point. The early history of Lyme, the 1970s and 80s, there was genuine skepticism in the medical community about whether it was even a real disease. The cluster in old Lyme was initially dismissed.
My cousin's wife has been diagnosed with chronic Lyme 3 times by 3 different practitioners. She's been on antibiotics for 4 of the last 6 years. She's not getting better. But she won't hear a word against the diagnosis because the first doctor she saw, a real MD, board certified, told her she was just depressed and should exercise more. After that, the Lyme literate doctor who gave her a diagnosis and a treatment plan was a lifeline. You can't reason someone out of a position they didn't reason themselves into.
4 of the last 6 years on antibiotics. That's the gut microbiome alone.
She's had C. diff twice. She knows the risks. To her, it's still better than being told she's making it up. I'm not defending the science. I'm saying the science isn't the whole story. The trust piece matters, and it got broken a long time ago.
The diagnostic limitations didn't help. When the test can be negative early and positive long after cure, you have a built-in ambiguity that both sides can exploit. Patients can say the test missed it. Doctors can say the test is a false positive from a past infection. Nobody's wrong, and nobody's satisfied.
Dr. Eleanor, my supervisor, she used to say that the tick doesn't care about your guidelines. She meant that the biology is messier than the protocols. She was an IDSA person, by the way, very much in the evidence-based camp. But she also thought the guidelines were too rigid in the 90s, that they didn't account for how variable the presentation could be. She wanted more nuance. She never got it.
What happened to the jar of ticks?
She glued it to the shelf after I knocked it over, said it was now a permanent installation. I drove past the Ag Station building a few years ago, probably still there.
That jar of ticks is going to haunt me. But it's a good place to leave this, because the question Daniel's prompt raises is bigger than Lyme disease.
It's about the limits of evidence-based medicine when it encounters conditions that are real to patients but invisible to tests. How do you hold space for genuine suffering without abandoning scientific rigor? The chronic Lyme controversy is one instance of a much larger problem. Medically unexplained symptoms are common. Chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, irritable bowel, these are real conditions that cause real disability, and we don't have clean lab tests for any of them. The temptation to latch on to a biological explanation, a bacterium, a virus, a toxin, is powerful, even when the evidence isn't there.
The diagnostic tools are getting better. PCR-based tests that detect bacterial DNA directly, metabolomic approaches that look for chemical signatures of infection, machine learning models that analyze symptom clusters. Some of that may eventually resolve the ambiguity. But, as Hilbert just reminded us, the trust gap is harder to close than the diagnostic gap.
For Daniel, in stores right now, enjoy the hiking. The Mansfield Hollow Trails are beautiful in late summer. The Fenton River is worth the walk. Check for ticks when you get home. Shower within 2 hours. Keep some fine-tipped tweezers in the bathroom. The system works for the vast majority of people. Don't let the internet convince you otherwise.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping this show running, and for the mental image of a jar of dead ticks glued to a shelf in a state government building.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you want to send us your own questions about diseases, diagnostics, or anything else, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's
the clothes from sloth, from man, from long ear hose, my windpromes. Until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.